You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Esther Rakusin. Have I pronounced that correctly or no?
Yes, you have.
Okay,
yeah,
good, good. I didn't check that out before we started. Anyway, Esther, it's good to have you on the show this morning.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me on, Eric.
And so the way we start is just what do we need to know about who you are to start the conversation? Who are you?
Oh, boy. Well, I guess that sometimes when people ask me that question, my quick answer is, I'm a professional volunteer. I guess that describes what I'm doing a lot of the time, running around to different volunteer activities that I'm participating in, and it takes up a lot of my brain. So that's one part. I'm also a parent of two teens, and that is sometimes a very interesting venture, being a parent of two people who are becoming independent beings or already pretty independent. I'm also a spouse of a person I've been married to for almost 25 years. I'm a sibling, and I try to stay in touch with my other siblings, and we, you know, I think observe what's going on in each other's lives. And I think I'm an observer. I like to observe nature. I like to observe other people. So I guess that's kind of a glimpse of who I am.
It lets us start the conversation very nicely. Now, okay. You brought some music with you, and what do you want to start with?
Well, it looks like I'm going to be starting with This Must Be the Place by the Talking Heads, also known as Naive Melody. Why did I choose that one? Well, let's see. Well, as people, listeners of your show know, that you ask your interviewees to choose some music, and I try to choose some pieces that I like. I like a lot of different kinds of music. This Talking Heads song, it's very simple, as indicated by one of its titles, Naive Melody. It seems kind of like a stream of consciousness thing that David Byrne had going on, if he's the person who wrote it. I'm not really sure if he wrote it or another member of the Talking Heads. I think it just sounds beautiful, some of the things that he says about, you know, him living life. It just seems to be kind of in the moment. Maybe he's making simple observations about it. Are you playing it right
now?
No,
we're going to start it.
I thought I can't hear it.
Yes, I must be having fun.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and I'm Eric Clay, your host, and our guest on this hour is Esther Rakusin. So, Esther, what experiences or experience helped to kind of shape who you are at this point in your life? What brought you to the place you are now?
Well, it's kind of a good question, actually. It's a very good question. I was just telling you a minute ago that my background is as a biologist. I attended graduate school for cell and developmental biology. I have my PhD in that field. And I worked in laboratory research for a number of years after getting my PhD, mm-hmm. Some of which was here in Ithaca. So I think that I probably thought that I was going to do research for my life. And then in 2000, I was taking a leave of absence to give birth to my second child. And it was sort of a good time to do it. I think I was having a little bit of frustrations with the project I was working on. And I thought that I would go back to work, but then it ended up not really happening. Mm-hmm. So I actually haven't really gone back to doing research in the lab since then. So that's been quite a bit of time. And I'm not really sure completely why that is. Mm-hmm. So in recent years, I've been doing a lot of different volunteer work and also trying to explore other areas that maybe I would like to find paid work in.
Sure.
And at this point, I think that I'm interested more in communications. And I like talking to people about things that I'm interested in. And I am still very interested in science. So I think I'm headed towards perhaps a second career in science communications. Mm-hmm. And actually, I would like to have a show here at WRFI maybe where I talk to people just about science right now. I mean, I haven't talked about this yet, but I am a volunteer here at WRFI. Yes. And I do the news. So yeah, that's something that I'm interested in. And so my experience working in science, doing research in biology has definitely shaped who I am mm-hmm. today. One thing that I think has also shaped me, which is a different kind of experience, is that I lost my mother when I was 30, kind of suddenly. And I think that it was not expected. Mm-hmm. And I'm not fully aware of how that has shaped me. I think that it's made me a more cautious person, perhaps more inclined to spend more time with my family. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's something that is still kind of undefined.
Right, right. A more reflective person, certainly.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I want to go back a little bit. What led you into biology and cellular, biology? Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not completely sure. I grew up in Bethesda, Maryland, mm-hmm. which is the home of the National Institute of Health.
Yep.
I knew a lot of people whose parents worked there, and I guess I knew something about the fact that people did research in biology. Mm-hmm. I did take my one AP course in high school was an AP biology course, and we were allowed to do some experiments. Mm-hmm. And that seemed kind of fun, and I enjoyed that. I didn't have anyone in my family who was a researcher, mm-hmm. so it wasn't really that led me to research. And then when I started college, I went to the University of Rochester, where there were a lot of opportunities available to undergraduates who were interested in doing research. And I, as a freshman, I somehow stumbled into a lab and just, I think, kind of introduced myself, asked if I could do research there, and started doing a project. I frankly didn't really understand a lot about it. Mm-hmm. Tried to understand a little bit more, but it was intriguing. It was exciting. Mm-hmm. And I think that ultimately the one thing that led me to do more research was in my junior year, I took a course in cellular biology, which I thought was so fantastically interesting. Mm-hmm. I thought cells were full of all this machinery that operated in such an intricate way, all packed into an unbelievably tiny package. Mm-hmm. I loved the microscopy, looking at small structures inside the cell. My professor was really fantastic at teaching, you know, all of the elements of what goes on inside a cell. And then a little bit later, I was able to, well, actually, that professor helped me find a position at the National Institute of Health during the summer of my junior year. And, or maybe it was my senior year, I don't completely remember. And it was a really great experience working in this laboratory. So I guess those experiences led me to eventually explore that as a career choice.
It sounds like you're comfortable following your curiosity.
Yes, yeah.
You don't have to have a lot of approval or other people breaking the ground for you.
Yeah, I would say that, yes.
Yeah, and that, yeah.
And even when I don't completely know what's going on, it doesn't seem to completely bother me. Although I would like to find out more. Eventually, I can get intimidated by others. You know, I encountered some professors who were a little bit intimidating, but I suppose that overall it didn't slow me down necessarily.
Right, right. So what happened, what wasn't quite right with the research when you took the leave and then didn't go back?
Well, at the time, at the time I was, I already had one young child and I would get to lab and try to get my work done before I had to leave to pick up one child from childcare. Mm-hmm. And then I was finding that I wasn't able to get it all done and having to go back in the evening and finish up what I hadn't been able to complete. That got to be a little bit tough. Mm-hmm. And then another part was that I was starting to get into an area which was intellectually challenging mm-hmm. for me. Finding like I needed more time to get to know this area and just wasn't really able to find that time and found it to be personally challenging. And so that also perhaps slowed me down.
Right. So you couldn't follow your curiosity because you didn't have the time. And right. You're also saying that this is from what I'm inferring, you were saying this is also the time in the few 5 years or whatever after your mother had died where things began to shift for you.
Yeah, yeah. I think that perhaps I was valuing the time that I was spending with my kids mm-hmm. and really enjoying it and thinking, you know, this is really nice, so maybe I should spend a little more time. Mm-hmm. Although I have to say that it wasn't totally conscious a decision.
No, this, yeah, yes, yeah.
Somewhat unconscious.
And so what I hear is that the decision kind of evolved in a piecemeal fashion as you discovered things that were hard to do at work and things that were fun to do at home, or at least, you know, compelling. And you never there's never an equal balance, you know, or, yeah. or a fixed balance, what I'm trying mm-hmm. to say. Yeah.
Right, right. Yeah, and I have to admit there was another part of it, which was that I wasn't always convinced that my work was heading in a direction that would be necessarily helpful to the field. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think that's one part of my personality is somewhat perfectionistic. So maybe I wasn't totally convinced. Again, it's something that I think that researchers might have to battle with sometimes. It's hard to really say.
Right. And I hear perfectionism, but I also hear the desire to make a contribution.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And those two are not the same, although they can often look alike.
Yeah. I think that personally, when I was doing my work, I did want to try to make a contribution. I wanted to make sure that the research I was doing was going to help in some way, either by, you know, contributing to the scientific literature in mm-hmm. a certain field, or you know, mankind, shall I say?
Right. Yeah. With quotations as you're marking it as we're talking here.
Right, mankind. Yeah, I mean, after getting my PhD, my research bounced around a little bit. Two of the labs I worked in, I was studying parasitic organisms, mm-hmm. which are, you know, they're pathogens that affect humans and also animals. And so I was feeling like, okay, well, this is somewhat applied research. Maybe the work I was doing would be helpful in some way in the future, mm-hmm. in helping to maybe develop a cure or a treatment for parasitic diseases. The last job that I worked in before I kind of had my retirement, so to speak, it was more basic research, which I definitely did not feel was... I didn't think that was like not a contribution, you know, I did feel like it was a contribution to understanding cell biology. I felt like it was really important, but it was a different kind of sure. research, maybe yeah. not as applied.
Right. Mm-hmm. Let's cut to music. I'll okay. give you a station ID while you pick what you want to play next. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Maid of Clary Report, and our guest is Esther Rakusin.
So how about the Andrew Bird?
Sure.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Esther Rakusin. Esther, that is a very interesting song about the dynamics of giving away what we do that's of value and trying to make sure that it's appreciated and honored. And when you described yourself as a professional volunteer, my ears perked up. We spend, even those of us who work 50 or 60 hours a week for much of our adult lives, we still spend most of our lives in unpaid labor. From the time of, you know, and we don't think of it, we don't look at ourselves like, if we were to study animals in the wild, we would know that because we would study ourselves that way. But we look at careers and jobs in this defining sort of way until we don't, or we see different sorts of things that we want to do. So you have, you stay
so
home
I guess
with the
kids. I spend all my time doing
well in unpaid, but also we aren't to do this. We also need other people. So you know, and that means that we rely on parents, or when we're children, or other caretakers, or when we're less able to take care of ourselves, we rely on Social Security or Medicare, Medicaid. You know, we rely on family and friends to provide all sorts of care, and none of that's, very little of that is paid.
Right.
So, so you kind of slipped into this as a mom who wanted to kind of step back and take care of your kids. And what have you discovered? What have you discovered about being a volunteer?
Well, I've discovered that there are many volunteer positions that I've found to be like really fulfilling and exciting and fun, but some of them lose that quality when. You find that you're being taken for granted, perhaps, when others aren't stepping in to help you out, and that can be a little bit disappointing. So, I don't know. Right now, I'm thinking of a volunteer position that I took when my kids were in elementary school. They were going to Northeast Elementary, and we had this really great. We, meaning the PTA, sponsored a really terrific program there after school called the Enrichment Program, which was completely run by parent volunteers. And we, the PTA, would kind of hire instructors as contractors to teach these one-hour classes to kids. So it was a very popular program, and a lot of families participated. We had even scholarships for the program. So pretty much any kid could take part in it. And I, at one point, volunteered to be a enrichment coordinator, where we, meaning, like, I worked a lot with another parent. She and I would recruit people to... teach the classes. We'd recruit parents to be kind of supervisors to make sure that kids got to the classrooms where they were supposed to go and stuff like that. And there had been parents before us who were running the program who established it, and it was really popular. So I learned a lot doing that. Learned a lot about, I don't know, just going out and finding people to teach the classes. That was like one thing that I did that was kind of fun. I would sometimes like do cold calls to ask people if they would teach a class in something. And I enjoyed that part of it. I sometimes would try to find family parents to be the volunteers. I think we called them, I forgot. It was like enrichment supervisors or something, and sometimes a kid would go missing, and that was really terrifying. And we would have to find where the kid was because they were supposed to be in their classroom. Anyway, just getting back to the volunteer part of it, I felt like it was very gratifying to be able to help make this program happen because I could see that the kids really enjoyed it. And the families, I think, really enjoyed having it there. But boy, it's hard when you need to find people to help out and they just aren't appearing.
Right.
That's a really hard thing. I often, you know, my friend, her name is Ivana, and I, she and I would like often kind of think like, how are we going to find more parents to do this mm-hmm. kind of volunteering?
To actually teach or lead the courses or just be in the room while they're being led?
Right. I think the thing that was hardest was to find people to set up the program, actually, right. which was a pretty time-intensive activity. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It was really hard, and it would take a lot of time.
Yeah.
So clearly, to encourage people to volunteer their time for free, mm-hmm. you know, they're not getting paid like that. That can be really hard.
Right. One of the things, we live in a highly professionalized community. Our population has doubled in the last 60 years or so, which is unheard of in upstate New York. And in that time is one of the most kind of professionalized eras in American history. And so the notion of community where almost nothing is paid for because it all happens by virtue of how we regard each other, we kind of don't know how to make that happen. And it sounds like you were, and when you have a community, there are people who are the informal mayors of their communities, where they know everybody, and that's kind of their role, is to know everybody so that those people can be identified and they'll step up because that's the norm, the mm-hmm. cultural norm. But it seems like we're growing in that direction, but the 1980s and 90s and early 2000s, it was kind of a little bit of a desert here on some levels. That was my experience of it, having grown up in a really strong community.
You feel like it was a desert in terms of the fact that it was harder to find people to participate or be
it's
part
hard
of the community?
It was hard to find, but the unpaid roles were not valued. It was mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. point that you started
right.
And that kind of work was not treasured.
Yeah.
And in a high-functioning community, that work is treasured, it's honored, and if people need some child care that other people pay for so they can do it, it happens because people know that they're looking out after each other's kind of whole life. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And because there are people who can afford to volunteer it completely, but there are others who can't afford to volunteer everything, so they need a little support. And that gets negotiated in a really high-functioning community.
Right. Yeah, I totally get what you're talking about. I do feel that I've felt both sides, actually. I mm-hmm. have felt a little bit judged, I think, by some who feel like, okay, so you don't have a paying job. So right. That's interesting that you consider yourself a professional volunteer, you know. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then on the
other
side,
because you're skillful and you're competent and you know that.
Well, I like to think that, but I understand it also might seem strange to some that I've, you know, given up a professional career. You know, I mm-hmm. have my PhD. I'm, you know, a trained researcher, and yet I'm not doing that right now. Mm-hmm. So I imagine that it must seem really weird, especially in this kind of community. And I've had a bit of a hard time dealing with that myself, mm-hmm. you know, kind of.
Where do you,
you know,
question
allowing it? Myself to feel like that's okay.
Yeah, what do you question about yourself?
Oh, well, I guess I question, you know, why did I go to all the trouble of getting this advanced degree and just not continue in it? Although, I don't know, I think that in some ways it has informed the way that I've conducted some of my volunteer work, you know, mm-hmm. And that I haven't completely given up, you know, I haven't mm-hmm. completely given up my interest in science and in biology.
Right. And you were saying you're looking for ways to kind of connect it with some communication things, which would be a lovely segue from one, mm-hmm. one career of paid career to another.
But
paid.
Just getting back to right. the whole question about volunteering and, yeah. you know, why, how does a person find a place in their life for that? I would like to say that I think that people who do work outside the home, you know, have a paid job mm-hmm. outside the home, probably do have room to do a little bit of volunteering, mm-hmm. and they may not realize it, but would encourage people to do that and see if they can put in a couple of hours here and there, because it would be very highly valued by others.
Right, right. And it could be related to what you do professionally, or it could be a kind of a counterpoint, something to give you a release and experience something you wouldn't normally do, mm-hmm. An avocation or just an interest. But what I want to go back to... You're saying you wonder, why did you go to all the trouble of a PhD? Well, I have an MDiv, which is a 3-year degree, and a PhD, which took me 11 years to finish, although I really only worked on it steadily about 7 of those years, and the others were part-time. Part of it is we don't think of ourselves as shaping our lives and shaping the people we are. We tend to think of it in terms of the strategic job or skill that we'll get and whether we'll use it or not. But really, it's as a human being, you're being shaped as a person, and you can't know 20 years down the road when you started something whether you're going to still be in it or not, whether it's a career or a marriage or whatever, and you work to figure out if it can morph with you mm-hmm. over time, mm-hmm. and sometimes, and often it does, but often it doesn't.
Right.
But we don't look at our lives as works of art and treasure that we shape by our choices. And what you have just suggested is, why don't you do that? That's the way I would interpret it. Because mm-hmm. you have made choices that took you off of a linear path, a professional path.
Yeah, and I have to say that sometimes I do feel like I've kind of stumbled into one thing after another mm-hmm. in a way. I think that... maybe it's my curiosity that has led me into different things, and it's often just been a surprise.
Right.
I didn't really expect what I would find out afterwards.
So, yeah. Is stumbling a problem?
It can be uncomfortable.
Uh-huh.
You know,
uh-huh.
Hopefully you don't fall on your face, which actually I have done once, for real.
Yeah.
But
yeah. I've done it more than once, for real. But that's Yeah.
I think it can be sort of uncomfortable, but I think it sort of suits my personality. I'm not a tremendous planner.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to plan a little bit more. I would like to be a little bit more organized about living my mm-hmm. life, but there's something inside me that is always tugging myself away from the planning part. I'm just kind of too spontaneous.
Right. And also, I mean, if you're willing to stumble, you're also willing to take a risk, but you're not an unlimited risk taker. I mean, you know what I mean, that's what I hear, is that you want to do that. And partly we only learn when we're surprised. You know, mm-hmm. If we knew it already, we wouldn't stumble or be surprised or have to kind of adjust our balance.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't often give ourselves that kind of grace.
That's very true.
Yeah. I'm going to do the station ID. Let's go to another piece of music. And you're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And Esther Rakusin is our guest. Where should we go next?
Oh, boy. How about First Circle?
Okie doke. Hang on. Let me just make sure I've got the... Okay. Yes. Okay. Thank you. Here we go. It's Pat Metheny, the Pat Metheny Group, and First Circle.
Thank you.
the Pat Metheny Group and First Circle, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and Esther Rakusin is our guest on this hour. So, Esther, what about this life you've lived has surprised you? What's turned out different than you thought it might or had anticipated?
Well, boy, there's a lot. I guess when I was, looking at that question, because you send out little, ideas, to your interviewees, I was thinking about when I became a volunteer at Cornell Plantations about 11 years ago, and I read about this program that they had called Wildflower Explorations, where you would go to training at Cornell Plantations and volunteer. Well, the person in charge of the program, her name is Raylene Ludgate, she would teach volunteers about wildflowers and basic plant biology and how to teach that to third graders. So I think at the time I was looking for a new volunteer thing to get involved in, believe it or not. And I didn't know much about plants. Even though I am a biologist, I was trained as a biologist, I literally knew almost nothing.
You were studying cells and probably animal cells.
Animal cells, yeah, yes. Yeah, and I even, when I was in college, I have a bachelor's in biology from college, and I never took a plant biology course, and I didn't take even a basic organismal biology course because of my AP class in high school, I was able to place out of the introductory biology course. Yeah. At the time, I thought, great, I didn't really want to have to take that. So anyway, I just remember going to this training program and going outside and seeing what the wildflowers were that we were going to teach the kids about. And I think the first one I looked at, I thought, that is so tiny. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't believe, I think it might have been one called Spring Beauty, which blooms in early April. It's a very, very tiny flower, and you could literally just step on it and not even notice. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. In fact, a lot of the wildflowers that we teach the kids about are like that. They're native wildflowers. And so it took me totally by surprise. And actually, since I've been doing this program, I've really become much more cognizant of nature in general. Mm-hmm. And more observant, look around a lot more. I, really enjoy, it really enhanced my enjoyment of the parks around here and enhanced my appreciation of Ithaca in general, actually. So I grew up in the suburbs outside of Washington, D.C., and I knew about, quote unquote, nature, but as far as I knew, it was dandelions, cardinals, robins, yeah. And since I started this program, it's really opened my eyes to nature in general. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's just one surprise.
Right. And I think you also had, and your kids and your mother and all these things have surprised you in different sorts of ways. What has something that you set out to do, has there been something you set out to do that turned out better than you thought it would?
Oh, boy.
Have you been surprised in that way?
I suppose maybe volunteering here has been really better than I thought. I have learned a lot of skills volunteering here at WRFI. I've met a lot of interesting people. I've gotten a little bit more courage about exploring things that I might not have been, I might have been intimidated about before. Mm-hmm. So that's been exciting. That's turned out better than I thought. Maybe there are a lot of things.
We don't normally frame these things this way. Why did you pick the news as the place to volunteer here at WRFI?
That's something I really stumbled into, actually. My neighbor, Lori Sonkin, who is also a volunteer here. She invited me to join here as a volunteer. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm also somewhat of a news junkie. And one thing I haven't really talked about a lot in my life, I think that another experience that has shaped me somewhat, and this is going to sound kind of trite, but was 9/11. Mm-hmm. After that happened, I started to listen to the news a lot more. And actually, I spent like a ton of time listening to the station and paying a lot more attention to what was going on in the world politically, mm-hmm. and just what was going on in the world in general. And so I guess I became a news junkie. So it would kind of follow that I would maybe start doing the news.
Yeah, yeah.
And also I'm very active in the community, and I seem to like communicating things. Yeah. So in effect, I'm volunteering, doing what I think is valuable and maybe what I'm good at, possibly.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And the heart of community is the communication of what personally matters. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of crosses that things that are not truly private, that are held outside of community, but it needs to happen with people, and it's not. And the media just becomes another way for the many people who are making those connections to get a chance to do it. And we don't think about it that way a lot, but you have enough humility, I think, to say that you're part of the news team, but also, you know, you have a voice, you know, and it's both. It's mm-hmm. both. It's both.
Yeah, I mean, I know that the news team is encouraged to participate in doing features mm-hmm. where we interview people. So I've also been interviewing people, and I pretty much can decide whoever I feel like interviewing.
Sure.
And so that is a, it feels like a kind of an intimidating role to have the ability to just choose who I think should have their voice out there. Mm-hmm. I think that it's a really nice opportunity to have. Mm-hmm. But I also would like to do more, and I maybe feel like I'm not quite doing enough. But there are a lot of voices out there that mm-hmm. need to be heard and mm-hmm. want to be heard. And yep. so I'm hoping that I can help with that.
Yeah. And there's a discipline, there's a practice, a spiritual practice, where one takes the first person that comes along and doesn't try to make an assessment about whether they're worthy or not, because in taking the first person who comes along, you then help the community to kind of, or in yourself, to become open to and engaged with whoever happens to be there. And we live in a culture that wants to define what's merit worthy, mm-hmm. Meritorious. We live in a meritocracy in some ways, right. with our PhDs and all this other stuff. But much of community is not about merit. It's just about being there, mm-hmm. and being known. And so what I've tried to do is to actually choose people less. So I invite people who are recommended to me by almost anybody, and I only ask that you be somewhat conversational mm-hmm. and reflective. Mm-hmm. It does take that, but that is my effort to try to get as wide a catch as we can, and even that is somewhat narrow because we don't cross all the boundaries, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me, what are you? We're gonna winding down to the last, 10, 15 minutes here. What do you do to sustain yourself? What do you do to renew yourself emotionally, intellectually, physically, and what I would call in some spiritually, if that language works for you, daily, weekly, monthly, and how do you know you need to do that?
Well, I probably need to do it more, actually, but I like to play tennis, mm-hmm. and it just feels exciting to me. I think it's just an athletic activity that I like to do.
It's a great physical sport. Yeah.
Yeah. And so in general, I like to do exercise. I feel like I need to do exercise at least a couple of times a week. And if I don't, get a chance to, then I can definitely tell mm-hmm. that.
What happens?
I feel kind of a little down. Mm-hmm. I feel frustrated. I feel a little bit more tired, actually. I don't feel as energetic. But, you know, definitely I feel kind of more grumpy.
And how long, when you do that twice a week, how long do you do it for?
Oh, not necessarily even that long. It's maybe 1 hour. I only play tennis maybe 1 hour a week, but mm-hmm. I try to work out at least 3 hours a week, mm-hmm. yeah. 3 or 4 hours a week. And that doesn't include just walking around.
Yeah, yeah, you know? Yeah. And walking is one of the best things we can do and just build it into your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like to get out into nature. I feel like that's also very restorative. Mm-hmm. We're so lucky living here, I think, you know, that you can just pretty much not have to go very far to find a beautiful park to go to. And now that I feel like I, you know the trees and some of the wildflowers, you know, it just it's very nice to just kind of look at them and touch them. And I've been trying to get onto my garden recently. My garden's kind of like my personality. It's very slapdash. It's a not very neat garden. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I don't have
highly planned.
I don't have neat flower beds or anything like that. I have a ton of weeds, but I enjoy getting out there and just pulling up the weeds, feeling the soil, checking out what's growing, what's needs watering, you know, a lot right now, stuff like that. That's restorative. I like listening to music. Probably would like to spend a little more time listening. I like a lot of different kinds of music, so mm-hmm. it could kind of be anything. Today, just, you know, you've been playing the Pat Metheny group. I happen to really like jazz. That's sort of more fusion-y jazz, mm-hmm. I guess. It's somewhat inspiring to me that, you know, his music, for whatever reason. I like classical music. I also like kind of indie rock. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So the Andrew Bird is kind of a sample of that.
Right.
Do you
listen to music by yourself or with others? What's the
kind of both? Yeah. You know, I sometimes I always try to listen to it when I'm driving around, which I do a little bit too much of. When I'm at home, I'll play music. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll listen to it with my kids. Mm-hmm. And I like to go hear live music, mm-hmm. although I don't do it enough, but I really do like going out to hear live music. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And finally, I'm Jewish and I go to services on the Sabbath. I try to go at least a couple times a month. And I do find that when I'm just kind of sitting, I'm not always paying attention to the prayers that are going mm-hmm. on, but sure. it's quiet and it's kind of meditative.
That is probably the most common experience of worship. Mm-hmm. It's a time out that we don't otherwise take. Yeah. Yeah. And so you've described the physical stuff and kind of the emotional stuff through the music and the time out. What do you do to restore your mind?
I've been in a reading group, mm-hmm. I joined this group kind of by accident about almost a year ago, and I didn't even really know it's a group of women, and I didn't even really know the women in the group before. We all had a mutual friend who passed away a little bit more than a year ago, mm-hmm. and I met these women at the kind of gathering after this person, after the burial for this person. Her mm-hmm. name was Martha. And anyway, the books that we've chosen have all been really interesting. I think that I've been in a book group just from time to time over the years. I don't know. I suppose that in previous groups, I had more of a part in choosing the books, mm-hmm. or I chose the group because of the books we were choosing. But this one has been really different, and the books have been challenging in a way that I've read things I wouldn't normally have read, you know, and because these other women who I really didn't know, they all have opinions about what they'd like to read. And so it's kind of, it's been fascinating. And yeah. And right now I'm reading a book, which it's called The Life of Elves. I really still don't really know what I'm reading. It's kind of an enigma. It's beautifully, it's written by a French author named Muriel Barbery. I had never heard of before. Mm-hmm. It's a lot about nature. It's very mystical. It's kind of a fantasy. Mm-hmm. It's kind of fantasy literature, which I don't usually read. So yeah, that's been interesting. Other things, I try to read a little bit of scientific literature. I'm not as much as I would like to. And there's my volunteering with the Cornell Plantations mm-hmm. has been intellectually stimulating. So those are just some things.
Right. And I noticed that there was a little bit of a, not quite a refrain, but almost a refrain, not as much as I'd like to, not as much as I'd want to. What's that refrain about?
Not enough time.
Yeah. And
There's also, like, I like to do handiwork.
Sure.
Embroidery, mm-hmm, knitting. Mm-hmm. I don't do a lot of it, and I'm not that good at it necessarily, but...
It gives you pleasure.
Yeah.
Do you find it relaxing? Is it something?
It is relaxing. Yeah. And that's another thing that I unfortunately haven't been able to really do enough of.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things that, and you, as a quote professional volunteer, there are no limits to the amount that you can do without compensation.
That's really true.
It's only a failure of your imagination or those around you who could point you in a direction. And usually there are all people who are all too willing to point you in a direction. And you have enough of an imagination that you have no problems, no worries there. So the working with your hands like that in a calm posture and the breathing that slows down when you do that is very much like a state of meditation. Mm-hmm. And it has the same kinds of benefits. So it's an interesting piece of your taking care of yourself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what do you see in the near future for you? Where are you headed?
That's a good question. Well, I'm, you know, headed into another life transition. I think my children are getting older, mm-hmm. and one already started college. So eventually they're going to be leaving the nest. Yep. So trying to figure out what to do with time that opens up maybe once they have left the nest, figuring out how to spend more time with my spouse, mm-hmm. and doing meaningful things together. Which will be really different, you know, transitioning into that.
It'll be a new marriage.
Yeah, yeah, looks like it.
Yeah.
I think that it's sort of a important thing to spend more time on. Also, I would like to move forward on maybe making possibly a career, either a paid or unpaid, of doing more communication, mm-hmm. science communication maybe. So that's another area. And hopefully spending more time doing the things that I enjoy doing, or finding time to do more of those things to kind of find more personal satisfaction.
Finding the pleasure, personal pleasure in what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And then trying to survive in this world, right? You know.
Yeah, there is kind of a backdrop of, well, not kind of. There's a huge negative backdrop, but
I haven't really touched on that very much, but it's, you know, I live life with a concern about how our world is changing, yeah. and how to live in a changing world.
Yeah.
how to teach my kids how to live in a changing world.
How they can be, how you can be even more resilient than you have been, and how they will be, have to be more resilient than they can possibly imagine now. Mm-hmm. Esther, it has been wonderful to get to know you.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
So we're going to close with Blue in Green by Miles Davis. Do you want to say anything before we play that, or just play it?
Well, you know, as I had mentioned, I really like jazz.
Yeah.
And always have liked the Miles Davis music from the 60s. I think it's from the 60s. It might be from the 50s.
Yeah, I don't know.
This is a really calm, pastoral piece. Mm-hmm. And it's thoughtful, and it has, you know, green in it, and it's kind of bluesy, so I think it's kind of like life, you know, kind of like my life.
Yeah. Thank you, Esther.
Thanks.